Almost there. With that, I will open a public hearing on HJR 33. Representative Kenemer.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, HJR 33 proposes amendment to Oregon Constitution to require acts that declare emergency to contain justification statement explaining factual circumstances of emergency and how circumstances differ from normal circumstances so as to warrant the declaration. Allows court of law to review justification statement to determine accuracy of statement. Directs court to strike declaration of emergency if court finds the justification statement is not fundamentally truthful or accurate. It does refer this measure to the next regular general election.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39. Nice to be with you, and I appreciate your having a hearing on House Joint Resolution 33. I'll just have a few brief statements. It's late in the session for this, but I do plan to reintroduce it in the future, and I think we need to start having a discussion. As most of you know, I served here in the previous century. And back then, an emergency clause was frankly an unusual item on a good portion of the bills. And I literally saw during the 80s that there were a number of occasions where bills got voted down simply because they had an emergency clause on them. And this session, I've noticed in what I think is creep. I don't know. I never did an accurate count. But it seemed to me that we had an enormous number of bills coming with emergencies clauses, and in certain instances they're absolutely appropriate and necessary, but I'm not sure they're necessary or appropriate in their frequency that they are now existing. When I had this bill drafted in LC, they indicated that at that point, 46% of the bills coming out of LC had an emergency clause. And I guess it raises in my mind the fact that this is kind of becoming a boilerplate approach to legislation, and I think we probably want to have a little bit more thoughtful place about that. I think there are times when political games can be played, and this takes away the opportunity for a referral. And I think one of the great things about Oregon is our initiative and referral process, the most liberal one, I believe, in the United States. And I think what's wrong with asking people what they believe? This bill, I appreciate, again, as in last session, the body put forward bills on Damascus, letting the people of Damascus decide whether or not their city should continue. I think that's a good place to go, is ask people what they want to do. So this says that basically you have to put some kind of an explanation, a reasonable explanation in it, and that explanation is subject to a court challenge. I just think it would be a good idea to eliminate emergency clauses from bills that don't need it, and to make sure that if they do, that it's really for a legitimate reason. And I think a good public process allows debate and allows the public to respond with time to respond. And I guess with that, that's probably really what I wanted to say. And I appreciate very much the hearing, and I'd welcome any questions or comments that you might want to offer.
Any questions or comments?
No.
No. Okay. Thank you very much, Representative.
I appreciate your holding.
Absolutely. And Dan Meek would also like to testify on this.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Meek. I'm here on this bill representing the Independent Party of Oregon, which favors this bill. It also favors direct democracy, as do the members of the party in responding to our questionnaires and surveys. As Representative Kenemer noted, many bills now have emergency clauses, and I would note many of them have emergency clauses even when the operational date of their substantive provisions are set months or years in the future. So it seems rather strange that you can have an emergency, but the operational date of the bill is next year or even the next year, but yet it's such an emergency that you have to have an emergency clause, which clearly is they're being adopted to avoid the opportunity for referendum. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? No. Well, with that, thank you, Representative, and I will close the public hearing on HJR 33. I will open a work session on House Bill 3470. Erin, will you read the measure?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3470 requires Environmental Quality Commission to adopt program by rule to achieve statewide greenhouse gas emission limits for 2020 that are at least 10% below 1990 levels and limits for 2050 that are at least 75% below 1990 levels and adopt interim five-year statewide limits consistent with reductions to meet 2050 limit. We do have a -A8 amendment. The -A8 amendment modifies reporting requirements of the Environmental Quality Commission regarding plan for adoption to November 1 odd year years on rulemaking and actions related to action plan for preventing accidents of the statewide greenhouse gas emission limits and October 1, 2016 progress report describing proposed rules to be adopted as part of the plan. It changes the name of the Oregon Global Warming Commission to Oregon Commission on Climate Change. It changes the commission's reporting date to September of even-numbered years. It removes Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, designates existing Environmental Justice Task Force to assist in development of the plan, clarifies Environmental Quality Commission's authority to enter into market agreements with other states and countries, requires action plan account for total potential costs and economic and non-economic benefits and risks with relationship to state's workforce, requires commission appoint members and workforce advisory committee to identify and advise on potential costs and benefits and risks of the plan with relation to state's economy, workforce, business industries. There is an emergency clause with the amendment. We have we've got minimal. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm just stumbling all over myself at the moment. We have got this measure does need to go to Ways and Means with the A8 amendments, and we have hall passes from both revenue and fiscal to move it in that direction.
With that, Representative Smith Warner, I would accept an amendment for the motion. A motion for the amendment. You started there.
It's contagious. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -A8 amendment to House Bill 3478.
Representative Smith Warner has moved the -8 amendments to Senate Bill to House Bill 3470. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection to
the
A8?
Maybe I should look at the amendment if Mike McClain likes it.
No objection. Seeing none. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3470A with a due pass.
Oh. As it's all right, this adds workforce.
As amended recommendation, and the measure be referred to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Smith Warner has moved House Bill 3470 with a due pass as amended recommendation to be referred to Ways and Means. Is there a discussion? Representative McClain.
I want to thank my colleague, Representative Rayfield, for reminding me what bill we were on. I misunderstood my, but I will be opposing this. I think we've got a lot of bills that have dealt with. In fact, I think over in the Senate, there's one going on right now, maybe. It's best if we put this aside and try to exit the building here without continuing to push the button that's going to endanger the one compromise perhaps we may have achieved. But at any event, I'll be a no, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification on our history, you may have said this, Erin. It came to us from Energy and Environment, and this is our first.
It did have a public hearing.
Yes. There.
Quite a robust. There's about 245 pieces of testimony from that hearing.
But our first time here.
First time here.
Thank you.
Correct.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Have we had any discussion as to the purpose of the emergency clause on this?
No Representative Wilson? We have not. I do think that the Ways and Means Committee would be an appropriate place to have that conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other discussion? Okay. Please call the roll, Zoe.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Kenemer.
Excused.
Representative McLean.
No.
Representative Nose.
Aye.
Representative Brayfield.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
No.
Vice Chair Smith Warner.
Aye.
Chair Hoyle.
Aye. Motion passes, and House Bill 3470 will be referred to Ways and Means. And close work session on House Bill 3470. Now, with that, I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 832. Erin, will you describe the motion?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 832 establishes behavioral health homes to be used for coordinated care organizations, requires Oregon Health Authority to set standards for achieving integration of behavioral and physical health services in patient-centered primary care homes and behavioral health homes via rulemaking. This measure was heard on Monday, at which time we did identify a conflict amendment that we did not have the paperwork for. We do have the paperwork now for the B7 conflict amendment that resolves the conflict with House Bill 2419. The revenue is a no revenue. The fiscal is a minimal fiscal. So before you, Madam Chair, is the motion for the amendment and then to move to the floor, Madam Chair.
I would accept a motion from Representative Gilliam for the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 832.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt the dash B7 amendment to Senate Bill 832B.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 832B. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. Vice Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 832A with the due pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved Senate Bill 832 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. We'll have Representative Kenemer as the carrier and close the work session on Senate Bill 832. And with that, we will open up a public hearing, an informational meeting with invited testimony only on the structure of major political parties. So do you have to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. And with that, we will call up. We have two people from each of the major parties or two major parties and the soon-to-be major party. So I will start with the right and move left, because that's what I do. So with that, Mr. Leo, come on up. And Mr. Currier, and thank you so much for joining us today. Just as we start this, just so that people know, we're here to discuss Oregon's political party structures. The system is changing due to new major parties and minor parties that are growing, and it's been a long time since we've thoroughly reviewed the rules and the laws to make sure they meet the needs of the state and the voters. Our laws rightfully require that the parties are organized in a way that ensures the widest and fairest possible representation. Oregon Statute 248.005 states each political party by rule shall ensure the widest and fairest representation of party members in the party organization and activities. Rules should be adopted by procedures that are assured a fair and open participation of all interested party members. So the goal today is to learn how each different party ensures that. And with that, I'm going to have a set of questions that I'll just ask everyone so that we can get answers to the same questions. The first is, could you share with us how your party is set up for maximum participation by members?
Yes. The Oregon Republican Party is...
And just identify yourself.
I'm sorry. For the record, Chair Hoyle, I am Bill Currier, Chair of the Oregon Republican Party.
Welcome.
And thank you for inviting me to testify. So the Oregon Republican Party is composed of activists throughout the state that are selected at the county level And those are PCPs, precinct committee persons. And those folks then elect county-level officers who then form a state central committee that then elects the state party leadership. And that is how I was elected.
Chair Hoyle, for the record, my name is Greg Leo. I'm here today in a capacity as a volunteer for the Oregon Republican Party. I'm the former executive director and chief staff of the party. The party does a number of things to reach out to the grassroots level. We're very precinct committee person oriented. Of course, those precinct committee people run for office just as you do by filing with the Secretary of State's office, are elected then by the members of their party in the precinct, then form county central committees, which in turn then elect the state central committee at the biennial meeting, which happens in February every 2 years after the general election. It's a very broad based grassroots oriented process. We spend a huge amount of time informing people at the grassroots level about the party structure, how to participate, et cetera. Bill, I hope that.
And I would just add that the precinct committee persons that are elected at the county level are done under statute. So once those folks have been elected, and then the process continues on up to create the representative form that we have.
Okay, and I think part of this was answered. You know, could you describe what we're looking for is transparency and engagement. So can you let us know where, how do you achieve that transparency, that engagement, and
Yes, so every Republican in Oregon has the opportunity to become a PCP. The meetings that we hold are open to all members of the Oregon Republican Party. The PCPs will vote in those meetings, and all of the rules and the bylaws that the county and state level party produce are done in a representative fashion through elections and vote. And we have, as I mentioned, about 2,400 PCPs statewide that contribute the energy, if you will, to that process. But at the highest level, at the state level, we have 128 members of the state party that elect the officers, such as myself and the vice chair, secretary, and treasurer.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, the noticing of meetings is a very important function that's set out in statute. We have bylaws that parallel the statute. So, for example, we're able to email widely to get people to attend the meetings. I just also like to point out, because I am the history buff here around the building, the Oregon Republican Party was founded on August 20th, 1856, so before statehood. The first thing they did was organize precincts and counties. And so from the very first day that the party existed, the emphasis has been on precinct organization, having deep grassroots, and being organized, I believe, in 35 of the 36 counties right now, with the 36th county making progress towards organization. Yeah.
Okay, and then last two questions. Do all your members have equal standing in the party, or are there differing standing within the party in terms of ability to vote, in terms of ability to choose leadership, in terms of...
I'm going to start with yes. All members do have equal opportunity to vote for example, Republicans, voters throughout the state have the opportunity to select the PCPs in their neighborhood. Those PCPs then equally have the opportunity to select the county level officers, who then have the equal opportunity to select the state officers. So, yes.
Okay, and then finally, what systems do you have to keep people engaged? Because I think that is the one thing that we'd like to see from all parties is it's one thing to sign someone up as a precinct committee person, but how do you keep people engaged, and what systems are in place?
Yeah, we spend a great deal of time, money, and effort training, retaining precinct committee persons to be able to engage their community on civic activities. And it's a considerable percentage of our budget.
Okay.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee also say that at the county central committee level, we recruit for school boards, fire districts, lots of grassroots. I think of precinct committee people as being kind of the connectors between local government and people in their precinct. So it was not unusual for my neighbors to come to me to get a stop sign put in at the crosswalk. That's the kind of thing precinct committee people do on a good day, I think.
Any other questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Rahill.
And so I was kind of curious. So if you're a layperson in the Republican Party and you want to become active, the first role would be to precinct committee person. Can any precinct committee person with become immediately run for, say, one of the county-level offices or one of the statewide offices? How does that process
yes.
work? Oh, it's just a yes. And then setting agenda, that was my other question. So obviously, as parties, we all set, our platform, things like that. How does a local precinct committee person gain access to the process to help set that statewide platform?
So a precinct committee person in a county can choose to run for an officer of that county and become part of the board, the governing board of that county party organization, which would then generally set the agenda. That's not to say that any PCP couldn't recommend items for the agenda, and the officers would probably incorporate that into the agenda. But the chair of the county, each of the 36 county parties, sets an agenda for what are usually monthly meetings of the executive committee. The central committee meetings are less often. That's the larger PCP group, but the board itself meets almost monthly in most counties.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Rahill, I would also say we have a policy process where we create a biennial platform. The platform convention happens in August. In fact, it's happening this coming August. Precinct committee people and just citizens will oftentimes go to county central committees and say, here is a desired plank in the platform, and in a grassroots sort of way, bring the issue up to the state central committee and to the state platform convention. And at that point, it's made. So it's a very involved, grassroots-oriented process, sometimes variable and unpredictable, I might say. But that's the way our system of government works.
Okay, any other questions? No. Anything else you want to wrap up with?
I would just say that our party values the structure that we have, much of which overlaps with 248, what's defined in 248. We do choose to opt out use the opt-out provision because there are some variances. For example, statute requires mailing of notices. We would like to use email for cost savings and so on. So there are some important elements that don't fit, but none of those elements affect our ability and our desire to be a grassroots organization that is driven by lots of participation and the leaders reflecting what the members want to have happen.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, there have been a number of new laws that you have passed this session. Senate Bill 29 deals with, precinct committee selection processes. We've also seen House Bill 3500 and House Bill 2177. All of those are pretty fundamental changes with how political parties work. So I think it's good in the interim between now and the short session to work collaboratively about how this actually turns into our bylaws and is implemented. So there's a number of major changes that this legislature has done, and I think it's a good time to reassess bylaws, to look at the statute, see what parts of the statute we might want to come back with recommendations on during the short session.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Since Mr.
Leo is the historical figure, I was kind of, and I appreciated the perspective. I was curious, in your opinion, as you look at these statutes, is there anything that you think needs to be updated as we start to move more parties into the system, or is there anything that you think might need changing or making better?
Yeah, I do. Chair Hoyle, Representative Rahill, yes. Things like emailing rather than having a statutory requirement, the U.S. mail, I think is like a good example of how we want to update. And the role of precinct committee representatives, as it will be soon, rather than precinct committee men and women, we have to also work upward to the Republican National Committee rules in order to have our delegation seated to nominate the presidential nominee. So there has to be, I think, a squaring of the new statute and what happens at the RNC level. So this will all take a very careful reading of the ORS. We think we'd like to work collaboratively with the other major political parties to see what changes they may need, and it could be that both parties will come to you with recommendations after having a discussion here in the next 6 months or so.
Or all three.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Chair Hoyle.
Okay. Fantastic. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Madam Chair, this is as good as it gets. I think we should close the informational hearing.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gilliam. I will take your recommendation under advisement.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and then from the Independent Party of Oregon, Sal Peralta and Dan Meek. Goodness.
Oh, wow.
Madam Chair, I'm Dan Meek, one of the co-chairs of the Independent Party, and I think that an efficient way to answer your questions would be a short presentation by Sal Peralta, the secretary of the party, that indicates some of our history and decision-making processes.
That would be fantastic. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah,
thanks.
Great.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm the secretary of the Independent Party of Oregon. I put together just a few short slides to talk about the party's history, how we're organized, and then issues that we see of import going forward. So the party was formed in 2007 after voters submitted more than 30,000 signatures to form the party. This was in response to 2005 legislation that made it more difficult to run for public office by petition and that removed the word independent as a descriptor on the ballots for candidates who ran that way. We nominated by caucus in 2008. The first candidates that we nominated were Ben Westland for state treasurer, Vicky Berger for state representative, and Jeff Merkley for U.S. Senate. In 2009, we helped to repeal the law that made it harder to run for office by an assembly of electors, making it easier for non-affiliated voter or candidates to run for public office. And we helped pass Oregon's fusion voting law, which clarifies our existing statute allowing candidates to accept multiple party nominations and have those nominations listed on the ballot. In 2010, we became the first party in U.S. history to conduct a binding statewide primary election over the Internet. We were the first political party in Oregon to conduct a primary election at our own expense in over 100 years. In 2011, we pioneered the use of the Internet to deliver vote-by-mail ballots and became the first minor political party in U.S. history to hold a televised candidate debate on network television in Portland. We've conducted now three binding statewide primary elections and one congressional special election at the party's own expense. In terms of platform building, 1,700 members participated in adopting the party platform and our policy goals, which I'll just read. The Independent Party of Oregon favors reducing special interest influence over our government processes, increasing transparency in government, particularly with regard to how our tax dollars are spent and how the public's business is conducted in Salem, protecting Oregon consumers, particularly with respect to banks, insurance companies, and private utilities, and providing incentives for small businesses to thrive and larger businesses to expand in Oregon in a way that returns more benefit to the public than it costs. The members, the same members that participated in the platform process, adopted several policy goals. I list six of them here. Requiring political advertisements to identify their main sources of funding, increasing vocational training opportunities for students in high school and community college, ensuring the tax dollars spent to encourage economic development return more public benefit than they cost, establishing limits on political campaign contributions, making college more affordable, and reforming the state primary election so that more voters can participate. And speaking to the process of how that was developed, we have in 2008, I believe, we started adopting a process of surveying our members as part of our election process. And so each two-year cycle, we do three surveys of our membership. The first one asked very generic questions about what they'd like the party to focus on. The second survey takes those general concepts and narrows them down into more specific concepts. And then during the legislative session, we typically look at legislation that seems to be moving and ask our party, our members to weigh in on it. And this was what we see here with the top five policy goals are the results of the second of those three surveys. In terms of party growth, it's been really quite extraordinary. We started in 2000, we were formed in officially in 2006. I think that's not right, wasn't it, 2007? Anyway.
Officially 2007.
Yeah, so we started 2007 with zero members and have significantly grown to 109,000 members statewide. That's created kind of an operational challenge for us. It's very expensive to organize large numbers of members. To give you an idea of how rare this is, for a party to do this, here's the statistics for the other minor parties in the state. You see the Libertarians are here, about 15,000. Green Party is the third largest now with about 10,000. The Working Families Party, you'll see, has invested some money, and they're at about 10,000 now. Constitution Party is here at about 3,000, and the Progressive Party is limping along at about 2,000. So this is unusual growth. In terms of voter participation rates, we're rather proud of the participation rates of our membership. In the 2014 general election, 64.8%. You'll notice that when we compare IPO participation rates, they're significantly higher than non-affiliated participation rates, which is the group that we're most typically aligned with. 2012 general election turnout, we were at 77%, non-affiliated at 71.9%. Party nomination method. I should point out, what is going around right now is a voter's pamphlet that we sent at our own expense in the 2014 nominating process to all of our 100,000 member households. So we're the only in terms of organizing and party nomination methods, we're the only organization in the state of Oregon to conduct its own statewide nominating processes of any kind. All other political parties in the state, both minor and major, conduct their elections via caucuses or conventions, usually attended by fewer than 30 people in the case of minor political parties. The analog for major political parties in terms of conducting their own processes are the filling of legislative vacancies. And so that's the only case where the DP, yeah, I mentioned Representative Hoyle and Smith Warner, I think you were both initially appointed. And usually these involve between 20 and 60 people, depending on the size of the district. With my testimony in the electronic testimony, I submitted some examples of reports that were given by the DPO and the Oregon GOP with regard to their nominating processes. It gives you an idea of the participation rates there. We conduct our elections via the internet. This is one area where we've been, I think, criticized kind of unjustly to some extent, because the participation rates of internet elections are extremely low on a global basis. In 2000, the Alaska Republican Party did a presidential primary straw poll, 1.8% participation rate. The Arizona Democrats held a primary for some of their offices in 2000 with a 4.3% participation rate. Estonia, the gold standard for internet elections worldwide, the only country that conducts its elections over the internet, in its first attempt at a 3.4% national participation rate using the web. Other examples, Americans Elect spent $35 million organizing an online presidential primary in 2012, but they suspended their effort due to the lack of participation. 1.4% of the people who signed up actually completed the process. And Facebook, which knows something about organizing online, stopped using internet voting on policy because of a lack of participation. After they only had 342,000 out of 900 million members participating for a participation rate of 0.038%. So in terms of policy going forward, we have just basic concerns about fairness in terms of, typically when the legislature has taken action in these areas, they have usually done more to weaken the rights of political parties to access the system when one of the two major parties was threatened. So an example of that was the laws removing the word independent from the ballot and making it harder to run as a non-affiliated candidate back in 2005. That was in response to Ralph Nader's campaigns in 2000 and 2004. Similarly, in 2011, we came to this committee. I don't think anybody on the committee was a member then. We're subject to an IPO death penalty bill, which was basically change your name within the end of the year or be abolished. Fortunately, that bill died. And since 2011, we've engaged the Secretary of State and other office holders in numerous conversations about party nomination process, and but no action's been taken so far, so I'm very thankful to this committee for considering policy in this area. We do have some specific policy recommendations, and I think Dan can speak to these better than I can, but really briefly, the subject of the open on the open primary, we have decided to opt in to the open primary for 2016. As both the Democratic and Republican parties can attest, having both opted in at some point previously, the method that the state has for allowing non-affiliated voters to opt into a major party primary is very clunky. And I know you took had a hearing on this earlier this session. What it involves is the counties send postcards to all non-affiliated voters, and then those non-affiliated voters respond whether they would like to receive a ballot of the major party that opens its primary, and then some relatively small number of those voters then get ballots and vote. And in the case of the most recent, I believe it was in 2012, the Republicans opened their primary election for statewide office, and I think 10,000 out of 400,000 people participated. Our position is that if only one party opens its primary to non-affiliated voters, why not just send the ballots to all those non-affiliated voters? It would save costs for the clerks and it would increase participation. In terms of election fairness, we think there's a strong equal protection argument for providing state funding for minor political party elections and allowing minor parties to either participate in the May primary or in a special election shortly after the May primary. To me, this is a really, it's a really important issue for the IPO because we're really on the cusp between major and minor party. And so we're going to operate by one set of rules for 2016 as a major party. And then in 2018, with the passage of the motor voter law, we're likely to drop down to minor party status and again be obliged to conduct our own elections. And there's a significant cost and risk associated with that. I think it's generally better if elections professionals, people who have been elected to do this, county clerks, handle these types of elections rather than political parties themselves. And I think if the state's going to spend millions of dollars funding elections for the Democrats and the Republicans and now the independents, that the smaller parties, whose costs would be much lower, should also have that opportunity. And then we have a point of view on freedom of association with our candidates. Being a minor political party and a fairly new political party, the major party statute that requires a 180-day membership requirement poses a significant obstacle for us because we need to be recruiting candidates around the state, and those people all need to be IPO members by September of this year, which is long before most people are thinking about running for, well, maybe not long before, but it's before some people are thinking about running for public office. We think the political parties should be allowed to establish their own eligibility rules for candidates who are not members of the party. We think that there is a strong associational right associated with this, and with that, I'll hand it over to Dan for any comments.
If I may, just admit a couple of minutes. First, the Independent Party of Oregon may or may not be a major party in the 2016 general election. Currently, we are 72 members to the good, and the final determination would be made by the Secretary of State on August 16th, depending upon the voter registration numbers there. So if we lose 73 members between now and August 16th, then we're not a major party for the 2016 general election. Regarding participation, Sal mentioned the surveys that we send to everyone that we have an email address. We also send to them other frequent, perhaps annoying emails asking them to participate in party functions. We have some nascent chapters in various counties who are now meeting in person. We also, as Sal mentioned, sent out that 12 or 16-page voters pamphlet to all of our members by mail back last fall, and it also describes opportunities to participate in the party. As far as election of governing bodies, we really have two governing bodies. One is a three-member state council, and another is a five-member, we call it the IPO caucus, which is in charge of doing the nominations. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's in charge of running our primary election process, which, as Sal described, has been primarily by internet or a combination of internet and mail-in voting. We notify all members of the opportunity to nominate members to the state council or to the IPO caucus by newspaper notice, and again, we email to everyone that we have email addresses for. One thing I would note is that I'm told that most of the county clerks don't enter email data from the voter registration cards, even if the voter voluntarily places the email address on the card. So I think that would be a notable improvement for communication with our members and perhaps for those in other parties as well.
Tim, may I clarify on that point? Oh, sure. I think the point is that our position is the clerk should accurately report anything that gets entered on the voter registration card, whether it's voluntary for the voter to enter it or not. Currently, the way the clerks treat it is that even if it's voluntary for the information for the voter to enter, it's also voluntary information for the clerk to data enter. And I think that the first of those is true and the second is not.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Meek. And in addition, we are considering opting into the precinct person system. There are some disadvantages to that, mainly the requirement for numerous in-person meetings, which requires members to travel either countywide or statewide in order to participate in the meetings, and proxy voting is by law prohibited. So opting into the precinct person system actually in some ways reduces the opportunity for participation by members of the party, and we're still considering whether to opt into that or not. Finally, as Sal mentioned, we have been seeking various changes that we think are necessary because of our status as a nascent major party, mainly a relaxation or elimination of what is really a 250-day party membership duration requirement for primary candidates. Nobody can run if we are a major party for 2016. Nobody can run in our primary who isn't a member of IPO by September 10th of this year. It's 250 days in advance. It's 14 months in advance of the general election. Now, that might not be a problem for established parties that sort of have tiers or hierarchies of candidates who run at various levels and advance as they go along. But I think that our candidates, or IPO candidates, will generally not be establishment folks. They're going to be coming out of the woodwork, and it's kind of a lot to expect them to come out of a woodwork and to plan on this 14 months in advance. As a result of that, we think most of our, or a good number of our offices in the primary election ballot will be blank. They'll be on our primary ballot, but they'll be blank, and so the winner will be write-ins. And that's the other problem with existing law. It allows anyone to win by write-in. So, unfortunately, under existing law, most of the races, I think, for IPO nomination in 2016 will end up being proxy races between Republicans and Democrat candidates, both seeking the cross-nomination of IPO by write-in. Which will result probably in about a quarter of all districts with one single person ending up being the Republican, Democratic, and Independent Party candidate for the same office. And that's kind of against our general purpose, which is to offer voters more choices and not the same choice with just a different label on it.
Can I also speak to that issue? One of the foundational principles of our party is that we have always allowed people from other parties to participate in our nominating processes. And that it runs squarely into the 250-day membership requirement. That those two things are in absolute direct conflict with one another. An organizational principle of our party is to provide ballot access. So for us, I've been encouraging Mr. Meek to file a legal challenge on our behalf on that issue, but it's also an issue that the legislature can and probably should look to address.
Okay, and with that, I think, you know, you answered many of the questions, but other than, do all members have equal standing in the party?
To vote for officers, yes.
Okay.
And to vote in our elections, yes.
Okay. All right. Are there any questions? Representative Rayfield.
So I'm absolutely fascinated with this topic, and I've like had questions for everybody because I think, you know, as I look through some of the statutes, I mean, the one is, you know, we have statute ORS 248005, which is it's basically to ensure the widest and fairest representation of all members. And I think as parties go forward, that's where we should be, and it doesn't matter what party it is. And so I started looking at the bylaws of each organization, and so I looked at your bylaws, and I quite frankly was trying to navigate through them, and it was difficult. And that, so when you said that all the levers, all of the members have the same level to be able to do stuff, that's not what the bylaws say.
No, I think what I said was all members have an equal opportunity to vote for candidates and officers.
So, and so I want to learn more, okay? So that's where I'm starting at, because it's very different than the traditional, like, say, the Democrats and the Republicans, and so I'm not familiar with it. And so when I read through, you know, there's basically why don't you take me through their governing structure? So we have the state council, and who is that currently made up of?
Let me, if I may, answer this question from Representative Rayfield. First of all, the bylaws of IPO are, of course, the bylaws adopted as a minor party. You will, if you check the bylaws of the Working Families Party, Libertarian Party, and others, you'll see those are also quite a bit different than those of the established two major parties. The state council is a three-member group. The IPO caucus, which handles the nominating authority, is a five-member group. Each of them is, as I mentioned before, is elected in a process where any member can vote, and we do put out newspaper notice of those in advance of when those votes occur. Voting in all of those so far have been done over the internet, which obviously has its limitations.
Okay, so who makes it? You have three people who are the state council, and who, mm-hmm. how were they elected and by whom?
They're elected by the full membership. Usually it's in the first few months of the even-numbered years.
They're elected by the full membership
of the party.
Anybody who's an independent party
anybody
member.
Anybody who's an IPO member,
okay.
Correct. And the election process for the nominating caucus is the same. Full membership has an opportunity to vote.
And who is eligible to be a member of the state council? The way I read it, that only a major supporting member is eligible to be a state council member.
Right.
So if I was just an independent party member, unlike the Democrats or the Republicans, I wouldn't be eligible to be in the leadership of
not
the party.
Not until you've actually volunteered and spent time participating and contributing to the organization.
Okay. And that was actually my next question. So
if I can
you see where I'm going.
Yeah, I do. So one of the ways that we are significantly different than both the Democrats and the Republicans is I believe Mr. Leo gave testimony that the Republican Party was formed in 1856. And I have a feeling that if you looked at their bylaws in 1856 and if you looked at the requirements that they were satisfying in 1856 or even 1863, it probably would have looked quite a bit different than they look now. And the reason for that is what we're doing is unique. Hasn't really been done. We're starting to see more of these independent parties pop up around the country. There's one now, I believe, in Massachusetts. Hawaii has one. Most of those are modeled after our organization. But what we have really tried to do is encourage people to participate, and as they participate, give them a greater voice in the governing process. And so we started when these bylaws were originally drafted. I'm pretty sure it was close to 2007, mm-hmm. And so we had to have some rules to make sure that the people who were contributing to the party basically had control. And so that over time, that is opening up, which is part of what we've been doing with expanding the number of active organizations that are meeting and regionally. And I think our goal is 36 counties and 36 active organizations.
And so just a couple follow-ups on me. So, and getting back to what does it take? So, obviously, if I let's say an independent party member wants to become part of the state council, part of the IPO caucus, I have to be a major supporting member. And the way I read it is that the state council, the three members, set the two qualifying levels of support or identify that to become eligible to become a major supporting member. So what are those two qualifying things that I would have to do if I was an independent party member wanting to run for the state council or wanting to be on the IPO caucus?
Representative Rayfield, I didn't bring this with me, but from my recollection, the two things, number one, and the most important thing, is volunteer hours. There are also, I'm trying to remember if we eliminated the monetary contribution as well, but the main tenet is volunteer hours. And, of course, we have always had a concern about being essentially hijacked by other major parties. That would be quite easy to do. For example, anyone could join if there were no restrictions on who could run IPO, being on the state council, for example. Anyone could join IPO and have nothing to do with us, have no volunteer hours whatsoever, spend $100,000 sending out literature to IPO members and get themselves elected to the state council and then vote to dissolve the party. So there needs, for a nascent party, there needs to be some control at the outset to make sure that you're not sabotaged. And we have been subject, and you know, we are subject to sabotage as a new party. There's a lot of folks out there who don't like the idea of a new party, particularly not a new major party. So that is a method of party self-protection. We have found, fortunately, that so far, maybe because of the way we structure our bylaws, there hasn't been that kind of a threat. I think, however, that we made a good decision to do that because we've stuck together now, going into almost our second decade.
If I can just camp onto that, I mean, what that has given us the opportunity to do is to build a base, a platform that then encourages people to participate, get active, and then become involved in the leadership structure. And I think if you look at the efforts of the party in terms of opening up its process, encouraging people to participate, I don't think any minor political party has done more than we have during the last 7 years. Nobody else is organizing statewide. Nobody else is giving every one of their members an opportunity to participate and using technology to leverage an opportunity for them to engage. And now that they're starting to engage, we're having more voices, and we'll continue to have more voices in leadership. That's the goal. More than a small number of people.
And you guys are very active, and I really appreciate that, and I think that's really important. I'm trying to really understand. I'd like to know, if I'm an independent party member, how many volunteer hours do I have to participate? And then who makes that determination of, okay, Dan worked 8 hours, that qualifies him to now be a major supporting member? Who sits where in what room and determines who becomes a major supporting member?
The state caucus approves the...
Is that the council?
The state council approves the volunteer hours. My recollection is it's not a lot of volunteer time. I think it's 20 hours.
Okay.
I mean, it's a fairly low threshold because we're trying to encourage people to participate and get active in leadership.
And then how many major supporting members does the IPO have right now?
I don't know.
Can you give me an estimate?
Fewer than 50 right now.
And then how do you – so let's say – now that's how I could become a major supporting member and get into the state council. What if I wanted to be on the IPO caucus? Do I also have to be a major supporting member to get on the IPO caucus?
I have to check the bylaws. I don't believe so.
I think you do, but I think in the past we've waived that. In fact, I know that we've waived that when people who have not met the requirement have wanted to run for the caucus. Uh-huh. The state council has waived that, 10 hours or whatever.
And so when you've had...
So we've had, I think, three or four candidates who have wanted to run who didn't meet the requirement, but we allowed them in.
And when you've had, your elections to become on the IPO caucus, I mean, that's something where they... what I was reading is if there's any vacancies, the state council actually appoints people to the IPO council.
Yeah, we've had no vacancies.
You've had no vacancies? Okay. That was, I was kind of curious how that works. Yeah. And how often does the IPO caucus get appointed?
Every 2 years.
Elected.
Elected. Thank you very much. Sorry, I apologize.
The nominating caucus is every 2 years, as I mentioned earlier.
Okay. And then, and to make sure I understand the role of that nominating caucus, that caucus actually, let's say that all of us were trying to, let's say, get the nomination for the IPO party. If there wasn't, this is outside of the open, all of us are trying to get the IPO nomination. That nominating caucus determines which one of us are eligible to run and which would then be on that pamphlet that was passed around, the voter pamphlet.
The participation in the pamphlet is self-selected, much like the state voter pamphlet. You can either be in it or not if you just decide to be in the voter's pamphlet. And I'm sorry, the first part of the question?
Yeah, and I should probably rephrase it. I was just trying to understand the actual nominating process for candidates.
So that's different now, right? As a major party, there's an example of something that's different between being a major and a minor party. As a minor party, our election is conducted and administered by the nominating caucus. As a major political party, that role is not theirs anymore. The Secretary of State and the county clerks are going to be taking on that role.
Okay. And the only reason I ask that question is because I've never quite understood from an outsider perspective, not being in the caucus, where I know that some people have been able to be considered on the ballot for the IPO caucus and some people just haven't, been chosen to be a part of that process. And I haven't understood who makes that determination and why.
Representative Rayfield, the IPO caucus makes the determination, and it's largely based upon the questionnaires, the candidate questionnaires. Every candidate is asked to fill out a very extensive questionnaire with asking for their positions on many issues. And that's compared to the platform that's established through the voter survey, through the IPO member surveys. And if there seems to be fundamental inconsistencies, then sometimes those who seek to run in the IPO primary are not approved to run in the IPO primary.
If I can touch on that, that's actually a fairly rare.
Representative Smith Warner has a quick question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I do apologize for Don. I'm just fascinated by the topic, so I apologize.
Do you want to finish, Sal?
I was just going to say it's actually fairly rare that we don't qualify people. I think overwhelmingly I was not on the caucus last year, but overwhelmingly the caucus has qualified the candidates who have applied.
Okay. Let me just ask to follow up on that. That's really interesting, because honestly, to me, that sounds more like an interest group than a party, to ask a broad series of questions to a candidate before you decide whether they're going to be allowed to be one of the people who you nominate.
Sure. So let's look at that, though. If you're an IPO member, you're in. The nominating caucus has no role. They just automatically qualify an independent party member.
Who wants to run as a candidate.
Who wants to run as a candidate.
Okay.
So if you're an IPO member, you're in.
Okay.
As is the case, so there's no litmus test for our members.
Sure.
If you're not an IPO member,
and you want the endorsement,
and you basically all you're coming to us for is a cross nomination, then certainly that makes sense to have an evaluation process.
I just might argue that perhaps it's just the description that you made of it. It would be one thing if, say, you said, here are six items, top items that have been determined. What is your position on these? And then you use that. Mm-hmm. That to me makes more sense than here's a big broad laundry list, and then we'll decide whether you get to. See what I mean?
Well, if I could, I would just, before you touch on this, Dan, I mean, yes, I would agree. What I've found is that, again, I wasn't on the caucus last year, but what I found is candidates are really good at vague responses to questionnaires during the process where they're filling out something trying to appeal to your sense of shared interests. And so to put the entire emphasis on a questionnaire, I can't tell you how many times Representative Smith Warner that a legislator or a candidate for office has filled out a questionnaire, absolutely said, yes, we are with you on campaign finance reform, and by God, we are going to get a constitutional amendment through this building, and then disappear as soon as the session happens. And so if we were to take them at faith, if we were to only use the questionnaires, then we would have no opportunity to evaluate the agreement in the candidate's actions to what they say on the questionnaire. We have no way of evaluating their history towards the independent party. Someone may be very good on campaign finance reform, but may have cast a vote to eliminate our party. Hmm. So using that as the sole criteria, to me, does not make a whole lot of sense for qualifying non-members.
That, using that as a sole criteria, you mean your five, your top priorities?
Using only the questionnaire, only a questionnaire as the basis for that, because again, people can.
But what you just said was that you use an expanded form of that, and then the committee decides whether they go to the ballot.
We send a questionnaire that's based on the party's agendas as selected by the membership.
Okay. Let me ask one other short thing. So the committee, the two of you guys, and who are the is that the committee,
State
the State Council, and how long have the three of you been the State Council?
Since the beginning.
Okay, and you are reelected every 2 years.
Every four.
Yes.
I've been reelected twice.
Okay.
No, the State Council members are, those are 5 year terms. The IPO caucus are 2 year terms, as I recall.
Okay.
But if I could answer Representative Smith-Warren, your earlier question.
Sure.
We certainly use a very detailed questionnaire to decide whether to allow non-members to seek our nomination. And I would note that your party doesn't allow any non-member to seek nomination.
True. And I'm just fine with that, actually.
Well, except for write-in.
Right.
We do actually allow that, because a number of people have gotten both Democrat and Republican and Independent Party.
Yes.
Yeah.
But however, you don't allow anyone to be on your ballot.
True.
Who is not a member.
That
we
is
do.
Correct. Yep. No, right. That's true. Representative Rayfield.
Yeah, and I deeply apologize. Sometimes I'm very direct in trying to understand stuff. I find this very fascinating, and I also apologize to the people on here that probably would like to make this informational session a little bit shorter.
Yes, we still have the other party to do. Our party.
I know. Trust me, I've got a list of questions for them too.
I trust.
Be ready. As I was kind of reading through it, you have the supporting members was the other. So we have our major supporting members, then there's supporting members. And the way I was reading is that the supporting members also, they're the only ones eligible to elect the State Council. It's the way that I was reading the bylaws. So, for instance, it says the State Council, the expiration of each a councillor shall be elected to a 5-year term by the supporting members of the IPO. And then the supporting members also have similar requirements of levels of support, one monetary, one non-monetary. And I know you said that the monetary thing may have gone by the wayside. So I was curious how many supporting members do you have in the organization, and again, are they the same type of determinations made by the State Council whether you are or are not a supporting member?
Yes, it's a determination by the State Council. Supporting member is a lower level of participation.
Okay.
And I really couldn't tell you how many there are at this point.
Okay, and then greater or less than 500?
Yes, less.
Okay. Yeah, less.
Okay. And then the last question, I promise, I so promise. Obviously, this is the way things are now as a minor party. You're obviously transitioning into a different world. And I was kind of curious, and I know you can opt into the system, and you mentioned you're going to opt into the open primary, but there's also the other statutes that you could opt into or how you might opt out. And so what does your future look like as far as, assuming, making a big assumption, and I know, Mr. Meek, you didn't want to, count your chickens, if you will. But what does that look like going forward?
Representative Rayfield, it looks like we wait until August 16th, to see if we are actually a major party for 2016 and continue to discuss whether to opt into the precinct person system. But as Mr. Leo mentioned, I believe the Republicans have opted out of that simply because it requires
mail
notice rather than email, and we think the more cumbersome part of that is actually the in-person meetings with no proxies.
So, thank you, Mr. Meek. To be clear, Mr. Leo said they opt out of the provision so they can make some small changes, but they do adhere to the basic structure and tenets of the PCP system.
And I think, from my point of view, that's the goal. If we'd been around for 156 years and had you know, a larger membership by this point. I think there's no question that we would be organized along that structure. But I would point out that, again, and it's part of the reason this meeting is timely, is that a lot of the requirements in the precinct committee structure, and email versus snail mail is obviously one of them, are geared towards 1950s party building. We have organized a lot more successfully online. One of the reasons for using the internet to deliver ballots was so that more people could participate. And I think that limiting to geographic region, for example, might not necessarily be the best model going forward. And in-person meetings, particularly in rural parts of the state, might not necessarily be the best model going forward. You can't have people having to drive 200 and 300 miles to attend a committee meeting if you can avoid it. I think that should be taken into consideration as you reflect on new legislation in this area.
Anybody else have any other questions? Did you have any other questions? Representative Wilson?
He doesn't.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anyone else have questions? Okay, so, and I, perhaps you said it and I didn't understand. So for the state council, how many people are on that state council?
Three.
All right. And this changes every 5 years, did you say?
Let's see. The terms are staggered, so only one is elected at a time.
4 or 5 year term?
I believe so.
All right, and then they make the rules for who can then be admitted to the party.
No, the state of Oregon makes the rules about who's admitted to the party.
Right. People who join the party by simply filling it out on a voter registration card.
Okay, but a member that actually can be involved in voting for officers, supporting member. So you define that group of three defines who can be a supporting member.
Right, by setting setting the levels of support. We modeled this on the Working Families Party.
Okay, so you do that. So you set the bar for who gets to be a supporting member, who then votes for the people that are on this, and how many people have been on that just throughout the time that you've had
the state
party's
council,
been in the state council?
I think Dan pointed out we're the same three officers.
Okay. Do you see yourself expanding that more as you become a major party?
Well, if we're absolutely, if we're a major party, particularly if we opt into the precinct person system, a major problem is obtaining volunteers to do the work.
Well, I think that the main point of the rules that we have is not to create obstacles for bringing new people in. It's to ensure that people who do come in actually volunteer and contribute. And we've tried to set the bar very reasonably low. I do not believe I've ever not accepted somebody's volunteer hours, for example. If I'm a secretary of a party and I'm going through and saying, okay, who volunteered, I've never said, oh, well, this person's not going to certainly get their 10 hours counted. I mean, the point is to ensure that people who are coming in, engaging, are actually, you know, doing the work of the party and then being involved in the decision-making process. I mean, that's the goal, is to expand everything.
And I think it's, you know, as a former party chair, I can tell you that it is the biggest struggle. How do you get people? It's always a small group of people that come in and that volunteer. And so having structures to ensure that people are engaged. And I do appreciate hearing about how you do reach out and have made that effort. And I think that transition to a major party will cause certainly for some differences. Now, every other major party has a two-year term for their, whether it's their officers, their executive director, usually after an election cycle, and you have a longer five-year term. Was that just because there's a small group of people that were doing the work? I mean,
I couldn't really say. Initially, I'd say yes. I mean, initially, the point was to ensure that we weren't taken over as a minor party as we were kind of struggling to get out of the crib. And again, over time, the whole purpose of this, and I think if you look at any reasonable view of what we've tried to do, it's been to expand access at every level. One of the frustrations that I have is the continued attacks that we get over this process, because I get the feeling that a lot of the people who are saying these things are just would prefer it if we would go away. So they're coming up with ways to make that happen. But no, we want to engage people in the process, and we want to ensure that there's a larger group and a more active group taking part in everything.
And I think from the perspective of this committee, we have a statute that outlines, you know, what parties should be. But as you're coming in to being you know, one of the major parties, we want to ensure that the rules are set up in a way that allows for that to happen. This, if there's a time to look at the rules, this would be a time to do it.
I mean, the flip side is I would caution against. I mean, we are a private organization, as every other political party in the state is, and I would just be cautious in terms of how you interject the heavy hand of the state into any party's process. I will say that. I think if you were to look at minor party bylaws generally, you would find that they are significantly different than any major party bylaws. And you know, this is just a transition process for us. And
so, I do appreciate what you're saying, although I would say that one of the reasons that as major parties, we understand that there does have to be oversight and transparency and involvement by the state, because these are the parties through which all of our people that do public service are elected. So it is in everyone's public interest that we ensure that there be fair, transparent, and equal access to, if you're going to be a major party, that should happen. And I think, we want to ensure that through this time through this next election, that we probably have a work group, that we look at things. What things can we change? What things can you bring to light as a new party coming in? And what things do we say, you know, there's a reason for this to be here, because what you may see as a heavy hand of the state, other people see as you know, again, fairness and transparency. So I think continuing these conversations is really very, very important.
Fair enough.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Shifting the subject just slightly, you know, the two major parties, Republicans and Democrats, have been around a long time, and they by no means represent the only folks who believe in either the Republic or in democracy. So putting that first, I'm wondering, on the selection of your name, have you run into any confusion about people who want to register as an independent versus independent party?
We've had confusion in two directions. The most common complaint that we get during our election process is by non-affiliated voters who want to participate but can't because they're not members. We've also had people who didn't register for the party purposefully. And when we encounter people like that, we encourage them to go and re-register if that's their choice, or to engage in our party. I think what has driven our membership growth is a frustration on the part of Oregon voters and on the part of the electorate generally with the polarization in the political process. And the perception, whether it's true or not, that the Democrats and the Republicans have gone to two polar extremes and are acting as though they were in two armed camps rather than working collaboratively. That seems to be the perception of the voters. And when we survey our members, that is one of the main reasons why they join the party. I think there is Gallup had a poll at the end of May that showed that nearly 60% of Americans are frustrated with the Democrats and the Republicans and would like to see a third independent party emerge. And when you have those kinds of numbers, I think it just stands to reason that some percentage of those people are going to actually join an independent party.
If I may, also Representative Co-Chair Gilliam, the last thing that the independent party wants are members who don't want to be members of the independent party. That just adds to the basically to the expense of running the party. Of course, the voter registration form, the first choice for anyone to make is not a member of a party, and then there's a list of parties. So it would take some effort to join the independent party if what you want to be is not a member of a party, because you would have to skip over the line that says not a member of a party. Finally, about 3 years ago, prior to 3 years ago, the form, the printed voter registration form listed each party with the name party after it. Democratic Party, Republican Party, Independent Party, etc. About 3 years ago, the Secretary of State removed the word party from that list, the words party from that list. So they're just listed now as Democratic, Republican, Working Families, Independent, etc. We objected to that change. That change wasn't, there was no rulemaking on it. It was just done. We wanted the word party to always accompany the word independent, but the Secretary of State took it off. So that was over our objection.
And I agree with you, Mr. Meek. I think that it should be listed because I think it's confusing. I think I mentioned to you last time you were here in front of this committee, I called through all the independent party members in my district and had single-digit responses of people who knew they were a member of a party. So they just thought, they really confused non-affiliated with independent. So I think, again, becoming a major party allows you, one, I think we should also have the word party, but it will allow you to, again, engage and let people know what they're joining.
Yeah, and
yes. Well, I think
I'll pass. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Rayfield.
Yeah, and I've mentioned this Sal before, whenever Mr. Peralta, when we've talked, and I spent a lot of time, you know, calling people, and the very educated people with law degrees are independent party members, and they're not aware of it. And I, from a party perspective, I think it is, and we're talking, you know, people with law degrees that are elected in the community, so who've actually navigated through the system. And so I think when you look at that, and you say from a party leadership standpoint, as you're trying to develop, I mean, potentially some of the need for, you know, some of these protective members in your membership portions of bylaws wouldn't necessarily be necessary if you had members who knew they were members of the party and actually wanted to be engaged in that party. You know, and I don't know if that's the case or not. It was just kind of, it popped up in my head, and so I thought I'd make this hearing longer.
Madam Chair, Representative Reese, really briefly, good Lord, we've taken up everybody's time. The only comment that I'd make about that is that when you ran, I believe it was in 2010.
Yes.
And I think over time that as we've gained more attention in the press, as we have spent more money communicating to our members, that there is a greater awareness. Part of the challenge, however, is as a minor party, we haven't previously had a ton of resources. I mean, sending out a statewide voters pamphlet to 100,000 people costs a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so we're taking the steps that we can to engage people. And again, where we find that people have made a mistake, we encourage them to re-register or take a closer look and see if it's for them. I would tend to agree that there's a fairly decent percentage that might not know a lot about the party, but they do in fact know that they're joining a party. I mean, they don't necessarily know a lot about us, but I think that's a reflection of the times where people are so frustrated with the two-party system that they're willing to join an organization that they don't necessarily know a whole lot about in the hopes that it will make things better. And whether we end up doing that or not, I hope that we will, but we'll see. Thank you.
Excellent. Any other questions? Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time today. It's really interesting. And again, this is a conversation that we will need to continue as we look at the statutes and we look at your experience, I'm going to assume, coming on as a major party and how that, you know, how we facilitate that.
Thank you.
So thank you. And with that, the Democratic Party of Oregon.
We can talk fast.
Last but not least.
I'm heading out.
Sorry, we took up a lot of your time waiting here, but
okay.
So I will just say, sure, the questions that we were looking to get answered, we asked the Republican Party and the Independent Party, either covered in their presentation, were asked, were, how is your party set up for maximum participation by members? Are your rules transparent and designed to be engaging and understood by members? Do all members have an equal standing in the party? And do systems exist that allow for ongoing and long-term engagement from your members? And then are there sections of ORS 248 that you think need to be changed? And if you have something here that we can read, you don't have to read it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chairman Hoyle and members. Yes, we do have something you can read. For the record, I'm Frank Dixon. I'm chair of the Democratic Party of Oregon, and sitting to my left is our executive director, Brad Martin. Okay, I think to respectful of the committee's time in the late hour, the answer to your questions are pretty much in the affirmative. Like our counterparts on the Republican side, we basically operate under ORS 24.007 at SEC. While they opt out of a few minor portions, I think both of the current major parties use similar systems that meet the standard of transparency and participation that voters deserve. And we've got 1,524 active PCPs in 27 counties. I'm elected as chair, I have to be elected every 2 years, and every one of the members of the Democratic Party have an equal right to participate from the PCP level up through the county party system to the state central committee and beyond to the national committee. So I can go into detail if you like.
I think the key thing, so your rules, we talked about the rules. Basically, what systems exist for you to allow for ongoing and long-term engagement from your members, and are there sections of ORS 248 that need to be changed?
Well, you know, long-term engagement is a significant goal of our party, and we work at various levels to make sure that happens. We have a system of training county party leadership. We meet on a quarterly basis. In fact, on Saturday, we will run meetings all afternoon on the systems of how we operate as a party, how to attract candidates, how to attract volunteers, how to become engaged in the various levels of the party. It's an ongoing and constant process. It's to our advantage to do that because we want educated members who are interested. And you know, we're not built on a premise of exclusion. We have a great history of participation. So,
I think that's accurate. There's multiple ways that the party regularly promotes how folks can be involved in the party, and it's everything from the
trains. Could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Brad Martin, Executive Director of the Democratic Party. Madam Chair, my apologies. Multiple ways that we encourage participation, both from how we encourage people to run for precinct peoples or be appointed as precinct people within the county party structures, trainings to county parties on how to recruit and activate folks, trainings within our caucus system on how to recruit participants in our caucus systems, which are a part of the state committee, as well as trainings for our state committee members. I would note there's a lot of other ways that we encourage democratic participation and voice, both in our platform process, whereby any Democrat can be appointed by a county party to help build the platform that represents the party. Any Democrat can run as a candidate for an appropriate district. Last but not least, we have a delegate selection process where, again, any Democrat by region can help pick who our nominee is at the highest level for the President of the United States. And then last but not least, the process that some of you are familiar with, the way in which we engage our PCPs in selecting people who are replacements for office holders that may step down or may not be able to serve. All of those processes are built on the idea of training, recruiting, and engaging folks within the party.
Excellent. Yes, Representative Rainfield.
I saved my most difficult question for my own party, which really is ORIS 248005. It basically says each political party by rule shall ensure the widest and fairest representation of party members in the party organization and activities, and that it rules and shall be adopted by procedures that assure fair and open participation of all interested party members. So I read that and I was like, oh, that's a great paragraph to aspire to. But what happens when something like that doesn't happen? And so as I was going through and I read even further in the statutes, eventually you get further back where it says, except as expressly required by law, the Secretary of State, a county clerk, or other elections official shall not enforce those provisions. So I'm curious, when as a party we do something that, you know, prohibits access, or who enforces that statute? Is it the individual member? Clearly the Secretary of State, it does not appear, has the authority to do anything. And you guys may not know the answer to that. It was just kind of... And we have this aspirational statement, but no way to enforce it.
All right. Representative Rayfield, I think you've pointed out one of the difficulties with that chapter is that you do have a lack of a legal enforcement mechanism. So when it comes to issues that, for instance, the county parties are under that chapter are independent of the state party. So I don't have any even organizational ability to go and tell a county party that they're doing something wrong and need to correct it. Within the, for instance, the platform convention, within vacancy replacement processes, as chair with my administration committee, which is essentially the executive committee of the party, in common terms, has the ability to go in and make corrections and to insist on following the rules, our bylaw rules or our rules of our platform convention. I have that ability, but I act only under the ability given me by our bylaws and standing rules also. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, I think that's spot on. And the only thing I would add is probably the single greatest enforcement is our members. They have an expectation of participation. They have an expectation of access. And they are not even slightly demure in making that known when appropriate, if they feel like the process is moving too fast or unfairly. And usually that's what it is. It's just the process is moving too fast and they feel like they need to slow it down to allow for participation. I do think you're at a unique point in history, because from the initial enactment of this law to today, you've had two major parties that by and large have complied with all the sections of the law, believe strongly in the transparency, the provisions that allow for participation. And you've never encountered the question of, well, what if one of the major parties suddenly said, not just opting out, but just literally weren't going to follow any of these rules, and you now have the formation potential of another major party, and you step to that question, is what would the state's concern be if a major party formed that did not either by voluntary means or by following the law, follow the law? And there are really compelling state interests for why this law exists and should exist with maybe more enforcement to it, very simply because not only does it describe the structure by which we nominate and move candidates forward, as importantly, this is the process that you've created to select replacements for either candidates who aren't able to fulfill their candidacy or for office holders who aren't able to serve. There is a compelling state interest that should be recognized, that this state should be concerned how people who are selected to fill vacancies in very, very important positions are what the process is that does that. And that process for us is spelled out by our rules.
I have a really short question.
Yes, of course.
I swear I will stop. No, I was intrigued to hear that the Republican Party said they had about 2,400 precinct committee people, they thought.
And it's going down, unfortunately?
Well, mostly I find it interesting because here in the DPO's testimony, they talk about only having 1,524, and I thought, now that actually...
But that's, get on it.
It's interesting because I think if you... Are the registration numbers about equalish these? I mean, I think we're a little higher.
Yes.
But it's not huge the way it used. I mean, it's because as NAVs increase. But I was just interested in that and wondered if you had any comment on that.
Yeah. It's something for us to continue to work on. I mean, obviously, Representative Warner, we're at a point in the election cycles where people have fallen off in terms of their interest. We expect during the presidential year that we will pick up in terms of not only registrations as we did in the 2008 timeframe, but we expect we will have more PCPs added to the rolls. We're also there's also, I believe, some tweaking of our ability to appoint PCB members, which will give county parties a chance to go out and essentially fill positions between election years, which I think I would anticipate we will take advantage of.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, Representative Gilliam, Vice Chair Gilliam.
Thank you.
Co-chair Gilliam. Esteemed
co-chair. Well, I just promoted him.
Get it all out. thank you, Madam Chair. My vice chair has just totally empowered me. I feel extremely powerful. You know, there are some ballots where you can, it says, pick four, or, you know, for local races. Just hypothetically, of the representatives that are left here in the room who stayed, if you had to pick five, would I be one of them?
No.
Let me help you, Mr. Dixon. There are only five people.
Yes.
Isn't that easy?
Well, Aaron's here.
I guess you know the answer.
And Madam Chair, Rayfield. I'm a little concerned that Mr. Leo did not stand up as aggressively as he should have. increasing my levels of concern at this moment. So.
Thank you so much. Anything? Whether fantastic. Thank you. Thank you all for coming today. And with that, I will close the informational hearing on party structure and adjourn the meeting.